How does society, how do our churches and our schools and our family of origin, what do they do that we lose that? What do they ingrain us with that we lose that connection with other beings when they hurt and suffer? So, I feel lucky, man. I feel really blessed. I say that probably 5-10 times a day, how lucky I feel I am that I think feeling lucky is a big part of staying centered, you know, because it's glorious, you know. Every day is glorious, you know. Every encounter is meaningful, and seeing the sunrise and seeing the sunset, and you know, hearing birds sing, and you know, when I walk on White Rock Lake, it's just all seems like, you know, like a honeybee that has fallen into a jar of honey.
Good day, folks. You're listening to the Spiritual Artist Podcast. This is CJ Miller, your host. It is a warm spring day here in Dallas. I'm excited. I see everything greening up. It's just going to be a beautiful weekend. I love this time of year because I see all the positivity of nature growing around us. I met today's guest at an interesting interfaith panel. I sat on an interfaith panel and immediately loved his energy and loved what he was speaking. And so I am excited to bring this guest in, Hadi Jawad. And he came to the United States back in 1972 as a young man in pursuit of a degree in mechanical engineering at the University of Texas. But boy, his life took a whole different turn. And so he decided that he didn't want to work in engineering because it was all the jobs at the time were military focused, and it just went against his spiritual nature, who he is. And I love this because he listened to that voice inside and he went off and he started a business. And not only did he start a business, but it sounds like he did very well with it, and he can share that. But he is a peace, justice, and human rights activist currently based here in Dallas. He is a follower of the principles of nonviolent resistance, as exemplified by the Reverend Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, and opposes militarism and war. And boy, this is timely right now all over the planet. And so I'm so excited to talk to him about this. He served on the board of the Dallas Police Center as an organizer from 1997 till 2015. He served as chair of the Middle East Peace Committee and media spokesperson. And what's so amazing, if you go and Google his name and look at his history, he has done so much and been so relevant with peace and peace rallies. He led efforts to organize protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq that culminated in the largest anti-war demonstration in Dallas history. And his time here in Dallas is not over. He's got some things he's working on right now, and we're going to talk about this, bringing peace into our lives. So good morning, Hadi. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It was wonderful to be on that panel with you also. It was enjoyable.
I did. I really liked it. And it's I can only tell my listeners that there's so much more. And I've been reading information and Googling your name and reading previous interviews, and you have done so much throughout your life to support peace. Peace through, and that's what was so neat about that panel, right? It was an interfaith panel. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, we had Muslims and Christians and Jews all together sitting down, just having a great conversation.
I know.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And that's I think it is not unusual. I think that's our nature. It is ingrained within us in the human spirit. To love and be kind to each other, and we are social beings. Human beings are deeply connected to each other. You know, people who take time off, get off the grid, so to speak. Some people in Alaska did that for 5, 6, 7 years. When they ended their isolation, they all recalled that the most difficult thing that they felt when they were in isolation for all those years was human contact.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, we are human beings, and we need to share that beingness with each other. And I loved the opportunity. I was invited on. I was like, me? Am I invited on this interfaith panel? Because, you know, I'm not a minister. And I do believe, you know, I do obviously support spirituality and personal growth and love of each other. And so it was so thrilling to be there. And also to hear you, you're definitely a good storyteller. That definitely is a way to communicate your message, right?
Story. Well, thank you. Yeah, I think storytelling is really important. There's something about the human psyche that if I was to sit here and lecture you about this or that, you will probably, you know, your mind will drift off into some other direction within a few seconds or minutes. But when you say, would you like to hear a story, it becomes a totally different interaction. And your mind, you know, relaxes and your heart opens. And human beings are storytellers. For millennia, we have been sitting around campfires and telling stories about our lives and our days and our experiences. So it's storytelling is a powerful, powerful means to convey to each other, you know, and talk with each other and talk about life, you know, talk about our struggles, our hopes, our aspirations, and what lessons we have learned and what we aspire to. And, you know, it's just I love storytelling. I come from a culture that it has an oral tradition. So it comes easy.
Wow. Well, you know, I want to use that as an opportunity to get you to tell your story about how you know, a lot of my brand, a lot of the spiritual artists is finding out that listening to that inner voice, that heart in you, what is yours to do? What is yours to do? And somewhere along there, reading your notes, you know, you were studying to be a mechanical engineer. You talk about how you were kind of gently forced there by your parents and by society. What? Tell me a story about how was this by where you grew up, your experiences as a child. What made you focus on the concept of peace?
I want to go back to my earliest days. I was probably 7 or 8 years old. Playing outside my house. I think I was drawing something in the dirt, just a kid sitting there playing in the dirt. And this wandering Sufi walked by and began to engage me and ask me questions about my name and, you know, who I was and this and that. And I was really, really enjoying. I was mesmerized by this person. He was dressed in the traditional clothes of the Sufis, and he had a begging bowl. He was a wanderer. And towards the end of the conversation, he asked me if I liked candy. And I said yes. And he took his staff and he stabbed the dirt with it. And where he had stabbed the dirt, he picked up a pinch of the dirt, asked me to put my hand out, and he put that dirt in my hand and then motioned to me to eat it. And I did. And my memory is him walking away and me tasting the sweetest candy in the whole world. So that was sort of my induction into the mysterious world or mysticism. If you want to call that, it had a profound impact on me. What an amazing world it is that we live in. So I think that's sort of like the beginning of my personality and my thinking, always gravitating towards finding the good, finding the miraculous in relations and things that we do. So I end up, you know, coming to the U.S. Because of societal pressure and family pressure, because all families in Pakistan at that time, I'm talking the late 60s, wanted their sons to either become doctors or lawyers. That was it. No other, you know, nothing else. Doctors or lawyers or engineers. So I ended up in engineering. I liked math. And I was a good student at University of Texas at Arlington. I especially loved the math that came with the engineering. You know, we would solve 7-degree equations by hand, which is you end up writing a 300-page book solving one equation, which monitored the flight of a missile, which is, let's say, encounters a gust of air. How does that missile stay on track? So that was the kind of math that we were doing. It was just absolutely fascinating, and I loved it. But towards the junior, senior year, especially towards the end, when the college began to set up interviews with local businesses where you could go to work, I figured out really quick that these were all arms manufacturers. I mean, Raytheon and General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin and Halliburton, and every interview was with these arms manufacturers. And it turned out, in retrospect, the engineering school at UTA is heavily subsidized by arms industry. So it was a heartbreak. I had spent, 5 years of my life going to college, and I had no interest in doing that. So where did the peace idea came from? I really don't know. I really believe, Chris, that it's a calling. I don't think everybody gets that. I got the call to do that long time ago, and I try to ignore it. What can I do? I'm just one person. Much better people than me have come and gone, and they have not been able to quote save the world. How do I think I'm going to save the world with my little ideas? But the call doesn't go away. If it is a genuine call, a calling, I try to ignore it as much as I could, and it keeps coming back, and keeps you awake. You get up in the night and you're still thinking about that. So I was drawn to it. It feels like.
Wow. I love that. That's exactly what I try to teach people, is to listen to that calling within and follow it, and I think there's so many people that don't. Walking around us are so many people that are doing things that they're not connected to. And once you're connected to what you're doing, I call that spirit speaking through you, right? That's God speaking through you, and you're doing God's work when it's something that's connected to who you are. I want to ask you about that Sufi. Now, you're not a Sufi though, right? You're
I've been initiated into Sufism. Had teachers. My first teacher was that wandering Sufi that gave me that candy, that dirt that became candy. but subsequently, I've been initiated into Sufism by a couple of Sufi teachers. I follow Sufism. It is the devotional aspect of Islam. It has no dogma, doctrine, except unity of being, that we are all, everything material, non-material in the universe is all one being, and we are all united in that one being. If it has any dogma, doctrine, it is that whatever the question, love is the answer. So I'm drawn to that kind of theology and thinking, and I relish it. And Sufis have made a huge contribution to human literature. They influenced the troubadours of Spain. They had an influence on many of the Christian religious mystics and readers and leaders. And Sufism is an ocean, and I have barely wetted my toes in it. So.
Raised Christian or Catholic, actually, they don't talk about other options.
yeah. Which is really, really has been different for us because, for example, Sufism, I'll give you a sample of what Sufis think. They look at the three monotheistic religions in a way that most people have not even heard of. For example, they will say that Judaism is the root of a tree. The trunk and the branches of that tree is Christianity, and Islam, Sufism, is the foliage. So there's a deep connection in Sufism. They completely understand how closely associated we are, Muslims are, with Jews and Christians. And you compare that to how we are manifesting that in the world is heartbreaking again, right?
Right.
We see, you know, the war that is raging right now, and but you know that is an example of how Sufis think, how connected we are, and not just Christians and Judaism, but everything on this planet. You know, every human being, every clan, every tribe, every country, every nation, we are part of that one being.
So
you know, they handle the question. They bring up big questions like things like truth, for example, that humankind has been struggling with. You know, who owns the truth? You know, we all pretend like we have the truth and the others don't, and you know, we build missiles to fix that divide that exists only in our minds. So Hafiz, for example, in the 15th century says, he says in one of his poems, I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, how are you? I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, what is God? If truth could be known from words, if the sun and the ocean could pass through this tiny opening called the mouth, someone should start laughing. Someone should start wildly laughing right now. So, you know, these are big things, and Sufis have a way of addressing these kind of things. You know, the truth is too immense for me to own, or you to own, or a country to own, or, you know, it's too immense. We can hope to move towards truth a little bit at a time, but we can't claim it.
No,
because the truth is too immense.
But I do like what you said. We can't claim truth, and nor should we try. But we can share love, right?
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, you know. And so we reach for what we can do. We can love each other. And I will tell you that this was a rough week for me emotionally, because I have. I supported, and I still support, the organization that was taking the food trucks in. I don't know if you read the news this week, and 7 of their volunteers got bombed on taking.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It crushed me. It just crushed me, because here we are. They were doing good. They were doing love, right? They were just giving food, getting food into Gaza, helping these people, and they get. 7 of them got killed. It was that World Hunger guy that does it, and he was. They pulled back now. Go ahead. Yeah,
Jose Andres. Yeah,
yes.
Chef Jose Andres.
Just such a spark of light, right?
Yeah, he is, and he's amazing. He's my hero. This is not his first gig. I mean, he has been in these kind of war zones for a long, long, long time.
All over the planet. Right?
All over the planet.
Never showing any sort of like favoritism, just helping the people that need food.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a world-class chef. He could be doing other stuff, you know, enjoying life, right?
Right.
And he goes out into war zones and takes these kind of risks to help a fellow man. You know, he's saying is what Christ said, you know, I am my brother's keeper. Yeah. I am my brother's keeper. Yeah, I have a responsibility and obligation to take care of those who need help. You know, those who are hungry, I'll feed them. When they're thirsty, I'll give them water. When they're in prison, I'll go visit them. These are all beautiful messages that Jesus Christ left us 2,000 years ago.
Right. I feel it so much. And that's what one of the reasons I love this timing of this interview, because we talked about this a couple months ago. And how do you know, and looking at your bio and your experience with so many different situations of social injustice, how do you stay and like, for me, like I saw that, I read that in the news, and it just hurt me so bad to see that, you know, I send money, I'm feeling good about what's going on, I'm helping someone as much as I can, you know. How do you stay in that centeredness of peace? How do you hold your heart there?
Yeah, really. I think one of the first things we learn to do is when your heart is being pierced like this is to feel the pain, you know, to feel the heart as deeply as we can, because we are human beings after all, and we are affected by these things. There cannot be any way that we should not try to avoid feeling the angst, the heart that comes with these kind of situations. That allows me to stay true to myself and helps me stay centered, because I have a core, I have a center, which is to some degree solid. After 70 years of life on the planet, I have found a core, a center in myself that I know can weather these kind of storms. Because when you live these kind of years, you've witnessed and you've gone through many, many storms. I think trying to avoid unpleasant feelings is probably not the right thing to do when you're faced with these kind of news or situations. I remember one time earlier on in my life when I used to watch the news, and I would sit there and cry. And I'm trying to watch the evening news and I'm crying because of all the stuff that I'm seeing on the news. We're affected. We are sentient beings. We are emotional. We care. We are connected. You know, we connected to others, and we connect to other people's suffering. That's the normal. That's not the abnormal. That's the normal. That's the way we are. That's the way God built us to be connected to each other. In Sufism, there's a saying that when one part of the body hurts, the rest of the body hurts too. So, and this is the way it is with other human beings. With, you know, when you see suffering in Ukraine or Gaza or Haiti or in our own cities, you know, we're connected. That's the bottom line. I just read an interesting story that I didn't know about. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the famous astrophysicist, he was talking about when a old tree in the forest gets chopped down, the roots of other trees reach out to that stump and provide it nutrients. And some of these stumps can live for decades and even centuries. That's absolutely amazing to me that trees have that level of consciousness. So it tells me that human beings, we are much more evolved. We have an amazing brain that we all of us have, and how connected we are to each other, and what are the things that we do to block that connection? You know, how does society, how do our churches and our schools and our family of origin, what do they do that we lose that? What do they ingrain us with that we lose that connection with other beings when they hurt and suffer? So, I feel lucky, man. I feel really blessed. I say that probably 5-10 times a day, how lucky I feel I am that I think feeling lucky is a big part of staying centered, you know, because it's glorious, you know. Every day is glorious, you know. Every encounter is meaningful, and seeing the sunrise and seeing the sunset and, you know, hearing birds sing, and, you know, when I walk on White Rock Lake, it's just all seems like, you know, like a honeybee that has fallen into a jar of honey, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that vision, that image. Yeah. I definitely agree. I totally agree with what you're saying. I think that you feel it completely. And then what I heard you say, and I'm going to kick this back at you, is to reach out to others. You know, feel it completely, and then reach out to others, and then have gratitude, you know. And I practice that all the time. This morning I got up and I heard a different bird call. And I'm like, what is that? What kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that bird. And how could I not know a bird? Because, you know, I listen to this stuff, right? And I'm going out there recording it, and I'm like, what bird sound is that? But such beauty, right? Especially this time of year when everything's just full growing. I love that story about the trees reaching out. I'd never heard that, you know? I do.
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, I thought, Neil, considering the source, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I said, man, this is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lesson for all of us.
Well, it's, you know, what I like to try to get people to understand is that love is science. Love is science because that's how things grow. That's how they evolve through expansion, helping each other out. There's a scientific nature behind that, right? I mean, you look at how the whole planet works. There's a sense of community when a flock of birds helps each other cross the country, right?
That is amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. How one gets in the lead and provides the right amount of turbulence for the others to stay in flight.
And they actually revolve. I've heard that, like, the lead, when it gets tired, the lead bird will swift to the back and let another one take the lead. And it's a constant. And so I think what I hear so much today, where, you know, people say science is at odds with spirituality, and it's not. It's not at odds with it at all.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. I never ever have thought that. It's all hand in glove. It's all the same. The scientists are telling the same thing that the mystics are talking about. You know, one good example of that is when we start talking about particle physics or string theory. Scientists try to explain particle physics. They start talking like mystics, man. You know,
they do, yeah, and they don't want to talk. That's why they don't want to talk about it.
yeah.
Do you consider, that's the second time you've said that, and I want to ask you this. Do you consider yourself a mystic?
So we'll have to define what a mystic is.
That's my next question.
So I'm drawn to things that, for example, in my activism, I don't normally or easily get involved in issues that a whole bunch of people are already involved in. My tendency is to look for opportunities to make a difference for people, folks that have fallen through the cracks, that will have no opportunity, no chance to highlight their suffering or what they've gone through or what they're facing. I think that comes from a mystical bent, is to look for the extraordinary, something that's a little different. I'm drawn to mysticism. I'm drawn to mystical thought. I'm drawn to love. I think love is mysticism. Just believing in love, that is possible, that love can answer any question that we confront in our relationships, in our lives, in our own struggles, and staying centered. I don't know.
You know, I agree with you. I hear different definitions of what a mystic is, but one definition I heard was a mystic recognizes the universalness of all things outside of any form of religion. Like, they don't have to have a religion to see that. They just feel it. So that doesn't mean they can't be in a certain faith. It just means that they see this, that beyond, you know, that's why I love that interfaith panel, right? It's like beyond names and categories. I see that we're all connected.
Yeah. I think mystics understand where the real gold is. Rumi calls the desires that we are swept away with sometimes as counterfeit coins. You know, we pick up what glitters on the ground and think it to be gold. So mystics, they know where the real gold is. And I'll tell you a little story about this comes from India. In India, there's a tradition that once you have fulfilled your obligation to your family. Like the son has grown up and started his own family. The daughter has grown up and got married. And you know, your obligations to your family are over. You go on a spiritual quest. You go from place to place, to shrines, to places of worship. And you go on this quest. So the story is about a person like that. They call sannyasin. So this sannyasin is on a journey, and he's walking through a forest, and he sees this big rock right on the path. And for some reason, some inner voice tells him to pick it up, and he picks it up and he puts it in his bag, and continues on his walk. Soon he's out of the forest, and dusk is about to come, and he's outside on the outskirts of a small village. And he sees this tree, and he says, okay, I'll stop here for the night, and I'll spend the night here. So he stops there, and as he's getting ready to go to sleep, he hears or sees somebody running towards him from the village. And the sannyasin looks up, and the guy comes to him and says, give me my diamond. You have a diamond for me. And the sannyasin says, what diamond do you speak of? I'm a poor man. I have nothing of value with me that I can give you. But the villager insists. He says that last night, Lord Brahma came into my dream and told me that I was supposed to come over here to this tree. There would be a man just like you that looks just like you, and that you have a diamond for me. So please give me my diamond. He demands it. So the sannyasin, the old man, he said, oh, he remembers he picked up that rock in the forest. So he reaches into his bag and says, oh, maybe this is what you're talking about. Here. And he gives it to him. So the villager takes that diamond, and he's ecstatic because he knows that he's going to be extremely rich. He's going to pay off all his debt, and the debt of his daughter's marriage, and he's going to pay off his house, and his life is going to be just in spent in wealth, you know, the years that he has left. So he goes to his house, and night falls, but he finds that he can't go to sleep. He's tossing and turning and tossing and turning all night long. He just cannot go to sleep. He's in this state of excitation. So as soon as the rays of the sun hit the tallest tree in the village, he runs back to the sannyasin and says, take this thing back. And he throws it back to the sannyasin, who says, yesterday you were demanding it, today you are throwing it back at me. What's the problem? What's the reason? And the villager says, give me the wealth that made it so easy for you to give the largest diamond in the world away.
Mm.
So Sufis know where the real mystics know where the wealth is. You know, it's not in these things. It's not in my car. It's not in my relationship. It's not in my building, in my house, or my mansion, or, you know, my gold watch. the real stuff is someplace else. It's in our hearts.
It's in the car. Yeah, I love that. You know, it's funny. I think you told that story when we did the panel, and I didn't get it. I was like, what? And now I get it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I do. And so I'm like, oh, the real wealth is what I would call your consciousness, your spiritual sense, your connection to all that is, right? And that's not something you can hold or weigh or give in a box or measure, right? It's
there you go.
It's of the spirit. It's, I love that. It's
yeah, it's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. It was told by Rabindranath Tagore. He was he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1911, the first non-European to get the literature prize, the first non-European to get literature prize. Rabindranath Tagore. He's the founder of Bollywood too. Everything you see in Bollywood comes from writings. Yeah, he wrote. I mean, he was a copious writer. But anyway, you're right. You know, those stories are like that. Sometimes you have to hear them once or twice or three times. Some of these stories are so arcane, you end up saying exactly like what you said. What? You know, what happened here? And then what has happened is there's been like a seed planted in your consciousness. And then, you know, a week later or 2 months later or a year later, that seed will sprout. And you say, okay, now I know what they were talking about. I have read many stories like that, and I've had that experience of not making any sense right then, but then something happens in life, an encounter, and all of a sudden it comes into focus.
Yeah.
I think that's mysticism. That's mysticism.
Oh, yeah. Do you don't go out and just tell stories anywhere, do you? like a poetry place or a storytelling?
We did that. Not right now, but we did that every once in a while. So I get invited to do this, but we did that. I just want to mention that to you. In 1997, some people might recognize this name, the Cosmic Cafe on Oak Lawn, a vegetarian restaurant. We started a Sufi poetry group that lasted until COVID hit, 23 years.
Wow.
Every Monday night, regardless of Christmas, Easter, Ramadan, snow, ice, rain, it didn't matter. Every Monday, people would gather there. It was an amazing experience. You know, almost 23 years of reading poetry sitting in a restaurant where people are eating and dining and talking. And, we learned a lot. You know, people would say, somebody quoted Saint Teresa one time and said, yeah, you know, this is exactly what she said. She said that you can find God amongst the pots and pans, the clanging, you know, the busyness of life. You know, yeah. If you just sit there for a second and think about it, you can find God everywhere, right?
Yeah, it's like that chopping wood, carrying water, right? It's in the physical motion, the presence, right?
Yeah, just exactly. Yeah.
Of the mundane, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Mundane. Yeah. God in the mundane. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, so I want you to talk a little bit. You said that you're working on something when we got on the phone before here. I want you to share that. In the notes of this, I'm going to revert to this interview that you just had. It was actually about a year ago with Maureen Kaki.
Yeah.
And I'm going to encourage people to read that because you have been involved in so much over the years. I mean, so many peaceful rallies and everything. It's amazing. But talk to me about what you're doing with the city of Dallas right now. You said that you're working on something with the city of Dallas right now.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. We had a meeting. We had our first meeting with them. Of course, the city is familiar with the work that we have done all of these years. So I work very closely with Dr. Rick Halpern. He is the director of the Human Rights Program at SMU. He was the fifth in the country to start a human rights program. You would think that every university, we have 5,000 universities, every university would teach human rights, right? There's eight or nine now. Rick was the fifth. So I worked very closely with Rick, and we have done many campaigns in this city that came to fruition that hopefully, you know, changed the consciousness at City Hall and the rest of the city. So what we're trying to do now is make Dallas a human rights city. A human rights city is a concept that was came out of the United Nations back in the 1990s. And the idea was to bring the principles and practices of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to local governance, to build a culture of human rights in cities and towns and villages. Eleanor Roosevelt, President Frank Roosevelt's wife, was a major player in creating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And she said, I'm going to paraphrase, she said that human rights, discussions of human rights should not be limited to nations, capitals, and London and Vienna and Washington. If human rights do not have an influence and impact on folks living in cities, villages, and rural areas, then it is of no use.
Right.
It should affect everybody. So what we're going to do with the Human Rights Dallas initiative in Dallas is to create a culture of human rights, and we're going to go about that by implementing certain programs. And the city was very receptive. Number one program is going to be we're going to start recording living history. There are people who live in Dallas that have lived in Dallas for 50, 60, 70 years that have been part of the struggle for human rights and dignity here in Dallas. People like Peter Johnson. Peter was sent here by Dr. Martin Luther King to start civil rights work in Dallas, I think in 1967, and then 69, he came back. He has seen Dallas for the last, 60 years change and evolve. So we're going to have him, and we have going to have some other folks like him. We have a list of 30 people that we will interview two, three at a time on a stage around the city, and ask them to speak about their lives, what they saw in Dallas, what is Dallas about, through the lens of human rights. We are talking with KERA and Channel 8, both of them, who are interested in broadcasting that program. The other thing we're going to do is have a human rights film festival here in Dallas every year. We asked the city if they will post a human rights calendar on their website, so we know the significance of events, national and international, related to human rights. We want to, on December 10th, we asked the city to celebrate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by bringing folks together and honoring any individual who has been exemplary in the struggle for human rights here in Dallas in that year. Also honor a business that is upholding the principles and practices of human rights. Honor a youth that has been active in human rights issues. So this whole idea is about creating a culture. So we start looking at all of our problems, all of the challenges that we face through the lens of human rights, and bring a different level of consciousness to our city. We believe that Dallas has come a long way. We were not too long ago the world headquarters of the KKK. This was in the 1920s. So we're only 100 years removed from that. We believe that Dallas has come a long way, but it has a long way to go. We also believe that Dallas is now a good city. We want to make it a great city. We want to make it a great city, along with cities like Barcelona and other cities around the world that are human rights cities and that have become exemplary in what they've been able to accomplish as far as human rights are concerned in their own cities.
Wow, that's great work. Another great thing that you've been doing. I wanted to ask you to share this with our listeners. If you're someone, some of my listeners are in Dallas, some of them are not, how do you on an individual scale, what would you tell the listeners, how do they promote human rights and peace? What can they do?
One thing is, the first thing would be to familiarize yourself with the 30 principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You can Google that really easily. You'll be surprised that these are rights that we all have. The U.S. signed that, so we are a signatory to these rights. The other thing is, when you read a newspaper or you're online reading some articles, look through the prism of human rights and see how that relates. What you're reading, how that relates to what you're hearing. How that relates to human rights issues. Those are a couple of small things people could do, and then obviously they can hook up with human rights organizations in their cities and connect with people that are passionate about that work and plan stuff, do stuff.
I love it. I love it. So it starts, you know, it starts here, right? It starts with the individual, really.
And yeah. Then, yeah.
And you reach out.
And have fun. You know, this is not supposed to be dreary and burdensome. You know, this is supposed to be, is expand our hearts and our horizons and expand the hearts and horizons of other people. So this can be fun. I had a good friend who passed away recently, one of my closest friends. We should say that those who know how to have fun are the ones that are going to win. You know, it's a winning strategy. So,
well, I'm sorry for your loss that your friend passed away.
Yeah. 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 He's in our hearts. Yeah. Yeah.
Left you with some great wisdom, right? You know, I will get those 30 statements, and I'm going to put it on my website, folks. If you go to the resources section on Spiritual Artists Today, you'll be able to download it. I'll have that when this interview posts for people. So they can share it. Is there anything else you want to share with the listeners before we go? Any other nugget of gold? I love that.
I would say love yourself, treasure yourself, treasure people around you, love them. Life is fickle. Every moment is precious. If you're looking for miracles, look at your toenails, look at your nose, look at your eyes. These are all miracles. That's it, man. Take care of each other and have fun.
Well, great. All right. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. This was great talking to you and all the work that you've done and It's very intimidating, you know, just reading about it. You're like, wow, this guy's done so much, you know?
Yeah. I tell people when they ask me how they do all this stuff, I said, I got nothing better to do, man.
It's your calling.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. And so listen to your calling. All right, people, thank you for listening to the Spiritual Artist Podcast. Make sure you like this and follow me on YouTube and or one of the Spotify or Google playlists or anywhere else. Follow me, and we will have more great interviews like this in the future. So go out there and be present and recognize what a joy life is just right now. Thank you.
Peace and love.
Welcome to the Spiritual Artist Podcast. This is Chris Miller. I invite you to join me as I interview artists from a variety of disciplines. We'll share powerful stories and lessons learned while making their art.